So the title of my talk tonight is The Three Layers of Delusion, or What the Heck is Happening? Which is, I've had that thought many times when I've been sitting, so it seemed like a good title. So to put this into the context of the teachings of the Buddha, in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Buddha's main teaching on mindfulness, the third foundation of mindfulness is called mindfulness of mental formations. And that sutta begins by saying, if you're full of desire, know you're full of desire. If you're not full of desire, know you're not full of desire. If you're full of aversion, know you're full of aversion. If you're not full of aversion, know you're not full of aversion. If you're filled with delusion, know you're filled with delusion. If you're not filled with delusion, know you're not filled with delusion. Well, the thing about desire and aversion is we usually catch on fairly quickly because there's a lot of strong emotion involved. There's a lot of like turmoil involved in both of those things. But delusion, the problem with delusion is that often we're so deluded, we don't know we're deluded. Right? We're just like lost. What the heck is happening? It's sort of what that feels like. And so what I want to explore is how can we have some chance of knowing we're deluded? And to do that, I wanted to look at what I'm calling the three layers of delusion. But before I do that, I want to go back and just look at this verse from the Dhammapada. This is verse 251. The Dhammapada is a collection of sort of poetic sayings by the Buddha. It's quite a beautiful little book. So there's no fire like passion, no seizure like anger, no snare like delusion. So there we have passion, desire, fiery. It's like hot, seizure of anger. Like we know when we've been seized by something, right? But a snare is like, how do you know you're caught? How do you know you're caught by delusion? It's subtler than the other two. So one-way delusion is described in various places in the suttas. It's broken down into three pieces, which are sloth and torpor, restlessness and doubt, and these are together the last three of the five hindrances, which is one teaching how this idea of delusion is explained. And I'm going to take a totally different angle. So if this doesn't sound like any delusion you've ever heard of before, it's not that you're deluded. I'm just coming at it taking a different approach to the problem here. And so what I want to say is that really there are three kinds of delusion. There's what I'll call personal delusion. How we, on an individual basis, all by ourselves, delude ourselves. There's what I'll call cultural delusion. These are more based on our upbringing and on our culture and on our political beliefs and whatever else you want to throw in there. They're sort of not so personal, the collective, but collective in a subset sort of way. And then there are what is called human delusion. This is common to everyone. Everyone, no matter what their race, their color, their nationality, their upbringing, doesn't make any difference. There's human delusion. These are things that are universal. And I sort of see these in layers. The first one, the personal delusion ones, are often easy to see after a while, if you're lucky. But there's a great, I looked in the dictionary. Here's the definition of delusion. A dictionary of delusion is a fixed false belief that is a resistant to reason or confrontation with actual fact. Sounds like the definition of politics, actually, but I'll be careful not to go there too much tonight anyway. So personal delusion. Personal delusion, I put the phrase here, caught in a fog. You ever feel that? It's like sometimes like you're just like, huh? That sort of strange, you know, I don't know what's going on feeling we catch ourselves with sometimes. And often when we've been in one of these deluded states and we come out the other side, the thought that arises is, what was I thinking? How could I have thought that? But while we're caught in them, they're quite powerful. I want to give you an example of one of these. This is just one I made up. But maybe it'll give you a better idea of what I'm talking about. Imagine you're going to work on the bus. So this guy's on the bus, and he looks up, and he says, sees this, you know, those signs on the top part of the bus that, with all the ads, and says, have fun in Cabo. He goes, ooh, Cabo, it's still kind of snowy here. Go to the beach, that'd be kind of nice. And, you know, my wife, you know, Sherry, she really likes going to the beach. And he sort of lets this sort of spin in his mind for a while. And by the time he gets to work, he's online and he's checking on, you know, resorts in Cabo. And then he finds this great place. Oh, God, this would be great. Yeah, and my Sherry would really love this. And, oh, boy, let's go to Cabo. And then he starts checking on plane tickets. And he goes to another website and he orders new fins and snorkel and mask that can be delivered before they go to Cabo. Because now he thinks, we should go next weekend. I mean, we should just go right away. And he's getting more and more excited as the day goes on. Then he goes home. And he says, hey, sweetie, I got this great idea. I've done all the investigation. I got new masks and flippers coming already for you and me. We're going to go to Cabo. And she looks at him with this sort of funny look on her face and goes, Cabo? Ooh. Yeah, I went there once. And it was horrible. The food was bad, and it was like, ugh, too many tourists, terrible place. At that point, if he's lucky, he will think, oh, I've been caught in a personal delusion, thinking this is all going to be wonderful, and she was going to love it, right? If he's not lucky, this is where a lot of fights start, right? What do you mean? I know you like the beach, and I've done all this work, and delusion leads to anger, leads to all kinds of other unwholesome mind states, just like that. Because he believed so much in this delusion that he's not ready to let it go. He's not ready to go, oops, sorry there. We do this all the time. You have a question already? Oh, well. That's what he might think. And then the equal delusions going both ways, yeah. But this is the kind of thing we do all the time. When I think back to my own personal life, the times I've done the most stupid and unskillful things is when I've been caught in some form of delusion of this nature, some sort of personal delusion where I thought things were going to be this way, and then I spoke or I acted on that belief, and oops, wasn't at all what I thought it was going to be, and all kinds of problems arise from those things. This is how we get ourselves in personal, if particularly relational trouble, on this form of delusion. And there's always a point where, like, the light comes on, and you have to at that point know, oh, this is just being one of those personal delusion fits. And you have to let it go. Because if you don't, if you cling to that delusion, you're so invested in it, then it just escalates and gets deeper, and then you start looking at variations of the delusion to make it better, or. So that's personal delusion. We also, you see this a lot sitting on retreat, but it could probably happen right here in this room on a regular weekly basis. You know, it's called there's things called Vipassana romances. You know, especially on retreat, you're sitting there. Of course, you can't talk to anybody, right? But you sort of see this person, you know, sits three rows over and two rows back, or see them in the dining hall line or something like that, and you go, ooh. You just get the vibe, you know. It's like, this is going to be great. And you start going, and this delusion starts to build. And before you know it, a couple of days later, you're thinking, you know, we'll be married. We'll have one of those new condos in Nobo, and two kids, and the right kind of dog. It's bold. I got the right kind of dog. And this whole story is filling your mind all the time. Of course, the other person doesn't have a clue, right? Because you can't talk to them, you can't signal them, though you're trying to think, oh, how can I check this out? You're trying to figure out ways maybe you can subtly peek just a little bit and see. And then this goes on for a couple of days or maybe a couple of weeks. Who knows? It's a long retreat. And then you see them do something. Or within the context of the Sangha, where this might be going on week after week after week, you might hear them say something like, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump, you know. Or if it's in the silent situation, it might be something like, you know, they pick their nose or scratch their butt. Or is it something that you go, ooh, ooh. And the next day, all that day, right after that, you're going, oh, my God, how could I thought about this? No. And now you're divorced and you're having to go in and you're looking for a good lawyer, you know. And this is all just in your mind. It's all in your mind. This is delusion. We do this not only on retreat, we do this in daily life. This is a lot of what we do. We get caught in these stories of things we think are going to happen, and then we believe them, and then we start figuring out, and then they change, and we go in a different way. And they're just not true. That's the thing. You have to go, I mean, it's not that you have the idea when you see that person, ooh, I'd like to get to know him, her. I mean, this is being a human being. It's when you start believing that that's going to happen. That's the delusion. Not the, you know, the reaction, the interest, the whatever it was. That's perfectly normal. But you have to then, right at that point, you have to go, oh, yeah, but I know this is just illusory. You don't get caught in this story. But often we don't do that, unfortunately. So that's personal delusion. We all have different ways of getting ourselves caught in these personal delusion stories all the time. They're fairly easy to see once you see them. And you always have that, what was I thinking, sort of thought right afterwards. Like, oh my God, how did I get caught in that one again? Because, you know, these have patterns as well, right? Then there's the next layer past this is what I'm calling cultural delusion. These are things that we believe, quite sincerely believe, because that's how we were brought up. Or that's what we learned in school. Or that's the idea behind, you know, our national identity. You know, I'm a Canadian. All Canadians are modest and very polite. Right? Yeah, sure. But you know, that's that sort of national image, you know, that Canadians have. And then we sort of somehow or other try to live up to it sometimes even, which is even more ridiculous. But we all have these sort of delusory patterns of thought that aren't so obvious, because along with them, there'll be some sort of thought in the mind, well, of course, everybody thinks that. Or, well, it's always been this way. Yeah. There's the things that we've learned from the cradle, from whatever, from our family, from our culture, from our military background, from our whatever. You know, all the different ways we learn things, we get these views, these ideas of how things should be. And believe that they're right. And that if someone doesn't believe that, they're wrong. I'll give you another personal example. This is a personal example, actually. So go back to 1968. I'm in college taking a sociology course. At one point in the sociology course, the professor said, and this is like he was from the textbook which he'd written, said, basically, homosexual men, the cause of their homosexuality is they had an aggressive, dominant mother and a passive or absent father. And when I heard this, I went, yeah. I mean, it's in the textbook, right? I mean, and there's the professor talking about this. This must be true. And I never questioned it. This was like part of the culture that I was growing up in back in 1968. I was not very hip at that point in my life. Not that I'm much very hip now, but then I was even less hip. You know, I grew up in small towns, in blue collar family. The definition of not hip is how I grew up. Okay. So I didn't really have much clue. But because I'd heard this and it was like part of what was in this sociology course, that's what I believed. And it colored all of my interactions with gay men for many years. But much worse than that, I think, is the underlying insidious nature of that particular teaching, that particular idea. It reinforced the idea that gay men were kind of weak, maybe even a little wimpy. That was sort of part of the image, right? Because they were dominated by their mothers. It blamed it on a woman. So this was definitely part of the whole patriarchal, misogynistic world of 1968. It was all the woman's fault that their son was gay. Okay. Another interesting thing you have to absorb and think about. It brought about the whole idea of conversion therapy. It was like, this was a psychological problem that could be solved. And so we're going to have this thing called conversion therapy, which is still, God forbid, still being practiced today in certain sort of more backward corners of the United States. Though it's actually been made illegal in a lot of places. Thank goodness. But this was just totally deluded thinking on my part. And it took me a long time of actually like hanging out with gay men, people I knew, and then it turned out they were gay, and I was like, oh, this is like just like another guy, like anybody else, you know? And so on. And you can see where I'm going here. This was like something that was just so normal to believe. This was just like, well, of course, set it in the textbook, reinforced by the culture I hung out in, you know, which was sort of sporty basketball, football, go, go, go kind of culture that I lived in at that time in my life. And it just was total nonsense. But I believed it. It was true. And it did affect, I know, my interactions with gay men. Over time, I started to question this and question it, and then I'm sort of like, oh yeah, I'm there. I've been caught in this weird delusion all these years. But it took a long time. And we have in our, if you look inside, we all have many, many, many delusions of this sort that affect how we interact in the world. Be they political,
you know, all Republicans. Well, I actually know this really nice Republican. So they're not all. Yeah. And so on. But you know, it's like all these stories you're reading lately about, you know, people who are Muslim being treated in incredibly ridiculous ways. I don't know if you read the New York Times. There's a guy who was 26 years old. He'd just been to some conference in L.A. He was getting on the plane. He was on the plane. He phoned his uncle or something in Baghdad because he was Iraqi. Yeah. And he actually spoke in Arabic on his phone, to, you know, talking about what a great conference he'd been to and how good the food was. Right? A woman sitting in front of him heard him speaking in Arabic, ran up and reported him. He got taken off the plane and interrogated by the FBI. This is just cultural delusion on display. He's speaking Arabic. He must be a terrorist. This is just cultural delusion. Activated. Yeah. And encouraged, of course, by certain elements in the country at the moment. We're full of things like this. And we have to really watch. I mean, even this, you know, I have to be careful that I don't think for one second that I don't all still have some odd views about gay men. I live in a straight culture. And, you know, I'm a straight guy, and most of the people I hang out with are straight, but I know a few gay people. We don't hang out a lot. I used to live with a couple of gay men at one point in my life. But I can't for one second believe that I've got it all figured out. I have to know, oh, wait a second. I have to question all the time. And how to catch these ones is if you say to yourself, well, of course it's that way. It's always been that way. Everybody thinks this way. When you hear yourself saying those things, that's when you have to look underneath and go, oh, am I caught in some cultural delusion here? Because that's often the signal. Because you're so sure that it's this way. It's the right way. It's the correct way. I know it's true. It's always been that way. That's the signal in your brain that you go, uh-oh. You know, you have to sort of watch for these things. Here's a more subtle one. Along this line, we all think that we're really good at perceiving what's going on in front of us. That we somehow we're really tuned into our five senses and we know what's going on. And if someone asks us what just happened, we'd be able to tell them very clearly what just happened. I know a police detective. He tells me great stories about, you know, people at the crime scene telling him five different things about the same suspect, you know. So we know that's not true, but there's actually been some really interesting experiments about this idea that this delusion that we're really good at perceiving things, that we have really crystal clear perceptions. Because we don't. There's this thing that happens called directed perception, where we consciously choose to focus on one thing through one sense or two senses and sort of tune everything else out. It's good we have this. You know, I'm a handyman, and I'm always using power tools. If I didn't have really good directed perception, I wouldn't have any fingers left. You know, because when I'm using power tools, I have to really concentrate. Oh, yeah, I'm cutting there. Don't put your hand there. Put it over here. It's like you're really paying real close attention to what's going on. Without directed perception, would all be a mess. Especially anybody who uses power tools would be a mess with fewer fingers. So there's this experiment done back 20 years ago, I think now, at this point, at a university. And it was about the idea of directed perception. See how prevalent it was and understand it more. And so they got a bunch of just people to come, and they all got paid $20. This is at a university, so students back $20, good money. You know, probably have to be $50 now. But they're going to pay them all, and all they had to do, the instructions were: you're going to see a video, and there's going to be a bunch of basketball players passing a ball around, and you have to accurately count how many times the ball is passed. So it's a very clear instruction about what to pay attention to. And so then the people would sit down, and these basketball players would come on and have a ball, and it was like they're passing around pretty fast, and it's zip, 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 zip. But in the middle of all this, this guy comes in, he's dressed in an ape suit. He jumps up and down, waves his arms, waves, and then walks out of the frame. Then, after the video, the people are given this little test, right? You know, how many times was the ball passed? Most everybody could get that right. If not, they were really close. But then, a couple of questions further down, it said, you know, did you notice the ape in the video? A few people said, well, maybe, sort of, but almost everybody said no. Didn't see the ape at all. What ape? And then those people, when they said no, they then showed them the video again without the instruction to count. And there would be the ape jumping up and down. We're doing fine so far because they were testing their directed perception. But then the majority of those people then said something of the nature of, you're showing me a different video. This couldn't be the video I just saw and counted the number of passes. Because my perception's gone. How could I not see this guy in an ape suit jumping up and down, right? They just couldn't believe it. In fact, some of them complained about the test to the head of the psychologist. These doctors were trying to fool me and bum. I think they were so invested in believing that their perceptions were correct that they wouldn't accept that they hadn't shown them a second video that was different from the first one. They couldn't let go of the delusion they had of how good they were at noticing things. Yeah. Like, there's a guy in an ape suit in this video. But they just couldn't believe. They couldn't believe. They would not accept that they'd missed the ape the first time. A lot of people wouldn't accept that they'd missed the ape. Some of them got quite upset when the doctors kept insisting that this was the same video you saw before. This is delusion in action. The idea, the cultural idea we have that we're all really tuned in, that we see things right in front of our faces. Well, of course we see them. We don't. This is where a lot of wars and conflict comes in the world. I know this is the way it is. I know this is what happened. That jet didn't accidentally shoot that rocket that blew up that plane. It did it on purpose. I know this to be true. It's a fact. Those X, whatever you want to call X, are like that. And I'm going to, now we have to pay them back. So we're going to go blow up something of theirs. This is the mindset of the political world in a lot of cases, where we know those other guys aren't good. And so we get to do what we do to make it even. All wars start right from cultural delusion. Every one of them. You can't name a war that didn't start from without cultural delusion being at its base. Mass cultural delusion. We're right, they're wrong. So it's a powerful force in our culture. And
on an individual level, when we can start to see how we're affected by it over and over and over again, then we can start to break free from those delusions, not get caught in them so often, and not get caught in all the harmful effects of those delusions. Then we come to human delusion. This has nothing to do with culture. It's nothing to do with how we were brought up. It's not has nothing to do with anything other than the fact that we have a human body. The cause of this delusion is we took birth in a human form. That's it. These are called sometimes called the three poisons. Taking what is impermanent to be permanent. Taking what is unsatisfactory or unreliable to be satisfactory. And taking what is not self to be a permanent self. This is the core of the Buddha's teachings right there. All in that two sentences I just said there. This is what the Buddha talked about all the time. One way or another, he was talking about the fact that we believe that things that are impermanent are somehow, for us, going to be permanent. This body, my partner's body, my kids' bodies, my house, my car, pick anything. Anything that we cling to. We cling to them and make them permanent. This is delusion. Because nothing is permanent. Nothing. You can't name anything that's permanent. Everything is always changing all the time. The Buddha said this over and over. Over and over, in sometimes slightly different ways, but basically that's what he was saying over and over. We get caught in this idea that somehow I can make that thing permanent, either because I really like it and I want to keep it, but often we make things permanent because we're averse to them and we think, oh God, I hate that thing. And it's never going to go away. It's making it permanent. So it doesn't have to be something we like, though that's all more obvious sometimes. It's often the things we dislike, that we're averse to, that we're afraid of, that make us angry, that we make permanent as well. Because they're there all the time and they never go away, we think. But they all do. Everything goes away. Everything arises, is there for a while, and then it's gone. It's the nature of everything in the physical universe and the mental universe, for that matter. Things arise, they're there for a while, and they go away. But we want to make them permanent. You know, we get this really pleasant mind state while we're meditating. You know, we're sitting there and it's like, oh, this is such a great meditation. And we immediately make it, well, this is the way all my meditations are going to be. Now I've finally figured it out. I finally got it, right? I finally got it. And every time I meditate, I'm going to have this really pleasant meditation space from now on. I finally figured it out. And that might actually work for the next set, if you're lucky. And then it's gone. And then what do? We either get really unhappy because it's gone, because we'd made it permanent, or we try and figure out how to make it come back, because it must be permanent because I want it so much. Talk about a formula for misery and unhappiness. Trying to make something that happened once before come back again exactly the same way.
It doesn't have to be a meditative experience. That could be any experience in our lives about anything that was pleasant. Yeah. It's just delusion that we think, that makes us think that, that we think we can somehow make something permanent. It doesn't work. It's one of the big causes of how our own suffering, how we make ourselves suffer, is by trying to make things permanent out of things that are by their very nature impermanent. We think that everything is satisfactory. This is sort of a slightly different angle on the, you know, we think that my favorite example is Häagen-Dazs coffee ice cream. It's pleasurable. I mean, it's the nature of Häagen-Dazs coffee ice cream is to be pleasant. I mean, and maybe for you it's not that. Maybe it's, you know, Doritos or something. It doesn't make any difference. You know, some of us, I'm a sweetie. Maybe you're a salty, or maybe you like dill pickles, something. But everybody, well, we have these things, right? Like, oof. So we think that Häagen-Dazs coffee ice cream is satisfactory. Perfect. Always going to make me happy. Now imagine the following. Maybe even close your eyes. Imagine someone puts in front of you a bowl of your favorite thing, whatever it is, your favorite foodie thing. And then you take a spoon, or you just pick it up with your hands, or however you eat this thing. And you take that first bite. It's just so wonderful, isn't it? That first bite is like, yes, this is so satisfactory. And the second bite, it's pretty satisfactory. By the time, for me, a bowl of ice cream, by the time you get to the last bite in the bowl, it's still pretty good. But it isn't the same as the first bite anymore. And you just finish it. And then someone gives you another bowl of Häagen-Dazs coffee ice cream and says, "Now eat that." And my first thought would probably, "Ooh, great, I get seconds." Yeah. But by the end of the second bowl, it'd be like, "Oh, I don't want to let it go to waste. Yeah, I better eat this last little spoonful." Yeah. And then someone puts another bowl of Häagen-Dazs coffee ice cream in front of me, and it's like, "Ooh, I don't want any more. That thing I thought was perfectly satisfactory is no longer satisfactory. In fact, it's the opposite. It's like, ugh, if I ate one more spoonful, I'm going to be unpleasantly ill." I had to watch my language there. But you know what? So it's like we think things are satisfactory. We think things are going to be okay. But they're not. No thing in and of itself is satisfactory. It's just causes and conditions are such that at a particular moment, when I first got that first bowl and had that first bite, it was great. But as causes and conditions change, which they always do because they're just impermanent arisings, that same thing now is totally unsatisfactory. Totally unpleasant. So we make things have a certain quality called satisfactory or unsatisfactory. But then causes and conditions turn around, and maybe this takes years, and maybe it's not something as simple as a bowl of ice cream. Could be that person you thought was going to be the perfect life partner forever. It's like, we're soulmates. It doesn't always work out that way. You're lucky like me, it seems to, but it doesn't work out that way for a lot of people. Causes and conditions change. That thing that was perfectly satisfactory isn't so satisfactory anymore. Because causes and conditions changed. But we made something, this is the definition of satisfactory. Then comes the last of these, and probably the most difficult one to understand, at least for me. I shouldn't speak for everybody. This idea that we make a permanent self out of what is not self. This idea of no self, of no separate entity called Barry. And we have to be careful there, because now we're starting to talk about, we get into this discussion about relative reality versus, you know, real reality, if you want to call it that, or absolute reality would probably be the term. In terms of absolute reality, the sense that this conglomeration of thoughts and emotions and ever-changing, impermanent fluctuations is a separate self is delusional. It isn't true. It's just, this is just part of this flow of changing, ever-changing, impermanent conditions that arise, are there for a while, and are gone. The problem is, it seems, when I say that or when I think that, I go, huh? I sort of, it seems kind of real to me. You know, it seems pretty, I know it's not permanent, but it certainly seems real. It seems like this is me, this body-mind process. And in a certain sense, in the world of what we'll call relative reality, the reality of day-to-dayness, yeah, that's true. You know, it is true in the sense of, if I didn't have that sense of self, I wouldn't be able to function very well in the world. In fact, I've heard teachers say that people who don't have a strong sense of ego development, I don't know what the psychological term is, but who have a strong sense of self, have real difficulty taking up this practice at all. So it seems kind of contradictory, you know, one way or the other. But this is something the Buddha said over and over and over. It's another one of those things he repeated. There's a teaching called the Five Aggregates of Clinging, which is a teaching about how to understand the idea of no self. In the Samyutta Nikaya, which is a collection of similar teachings, there are 169 suttas about the Five Aggregates of Clinging. This was like the big one for the Buddha, because it was central to this idea of understanding that in the terms of absolute reality, there is no separation. There is no separation between me and you, me and this desk, me and the rest of the world. No actual separation. We're all totally interconnected all the time. We just don't notice that so well as we notice other things. But we're totally bound together, interconnected, without exception. All beings are connected. And this is the one we have to really work on, I think, more than others sometimes. I think, maybe I'm just speaking for me, because this is the one that I still really struggle with in terms of, I really understand. This is what the Buddha said. I've studied the sutta a lot lately and studied other people's writings about this to try and sort of get a grip on it. And it's really clear this is totally central to what the Buddha taught. That there's just no way, no exception. He was very emphatic about this. The other interesting thing is, the Buddha said when he was just about to be enlightened, when he was right sitting there under the Bodhi tree and it was about to happen, the last thing that went, the last thing he had to let go of was a subtle sense of self, of separate self. That was what was holding him back. So I don't feel so bad about being stuck in it myself a little bit still. It was like this was the last thing that left before he could finally let go and become enlightened, to really let go. I'll get the questions at the end, okay? So this is, I just want to sum up here. So we have to learn to recognize all three of these forms of delusion, both in our practice and in our daily life. As we get into the more difficult of these, the more likely to become clear through deep practice. You know, through really seeing things as they are. That's why I go on retreat to work with these ones, the human delusions. That's where I start to have little glimmers sometimes of understanding about them. And it's not something we can understand intellectually, which is the problem. We think, oh, if I just figure this out, if I think about it enough, I'll figure it out. We can't. We have to know these three for what they are. We have to see them at a deeply experiential level in meditation. That's why we sit. In the end, that's where sitting takes us, is that understanding of these three, which is my encouragement to practice, I suppose. The problem is in daily life, often we're just rushing along, right? That's part of our cultural problem. We're so busy just rushing on to the next thing that we never, in daily life, even catch these things. They're just like one little explosion after another of delusion in our lives, causing yet another form of unhappiness and trouble. And so slowing down is part of this as well. Just allowing yourself that time to practice every day. Just that time to sit and not be rushing headlong into the next thing all the time. That's why daily practice is so important, because it allows us a chance to start to see these things. You know, we'll be sitting there. Me, I build things, right? So I'm sitting there and I'm trying to figure out how to build something. Right? That's what my meditation is often about, deck joists and exciting things like that. And I go, oh, this is just like I'm off. I don't even know I'm going to get to build that deck, I'll say. Which is true. I'm planning for a job I might get. It's often what I'm doing. Oh, I can do this and I'm going to save money that way and make, you know. It's just delusion. And then I have to go to myself, oh, this is just delusion. Here's delusion arising right in your mind as you sit here on your cushion early in the morning. Who knows if I'll ever get to build that deck. Who knows if I'll be around tomorrow, for one thing, but I mean, that's a separate issue. The thing to watch for, I think, is going right back to the very beginning. Whenever you find yourself saying to yourself something along the lines of, what the heck is happening? That's when you go, I wonder if there's some sort of delusion going on here. I wonder if I'm caught in some sort of delusive mind space. That's the key, I think, for me anyway. The key is that when I find myself feeling confused and going, what the heck? That's when I'm being polite to myself. That's when I have to stop and look and go, oh, maybe what's underlying this? What's underlying this confusion? And often it's some sort of elusive space. And if we're lucky, sometimes we catch them and reduce the suffering, our suffering and the suffering of all those around us, which seems to be in and of itself useful. From a book called Go In and In. Those of you who know me, you've heard me read from this before. And this poem sort of describes this process of
breaking down these delusive nature we all have, breaking it down in some way. It's called staring at the bones. Sooner or later, life in its variety and wisdom chews the meat from the bones of my illusions. It sucks the marrow from inside and throws the dry bone to bleach in a pile. Expectations are treated with equal disdain. Stripped of their finery, they are revealed as nothing more than future plans, easy ways to stay safe, roadmaps drawn by a blind cartographer trying to imagine distant destinations. This is the present moment's boot camp. Life's lack of rules will be obeyed, or I'll spend my time peeling potatoes in the past. I can choose to leave behind the skeletons of what I thought I knew and raise the flag of truth on the front porch. I can take a single step and wait for the next one to be revealed. I can only know where I am in this moment. Anything else is a desperate attempt to clothe the bones and set them walking. Just says it all. Poetry is so powerful because it just can say things in ways that the images strike us. So there's only one thing left to do, and that is to dedicate the merit. Remember, what we're doing here is we're acknowledging that even anything we've learned tonight, or think we might have learned tonight, or taken in tonight, isn't ours. Because it belongs to everyone. So we immediately give it away. Spread it out into the world. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.